Before statements even began, California Senator Kamala Harris threw a surprise into the Brett Kavanaugh hearings on Capitol Hill today. On Insight, I'll talk with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, about what the senator said and the plan in general for this week's confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court nominee, which you can see and hear on our website. Then, California's legislative session wrapped up Friday with decisions on some key issues that now await either a signature or a veto from Governor Brown. Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief will join me with more of those details. Chris Nichols has been focusing on California's Prop 10, the statewide rent control measure. This is a good conversation to listen to if you're not sure what that proposition is asking. And then the story of what happened in 1965 when the government replaced migrant farm workers with high schoolers. It's a piece by Gustavo Arellano. He'll join us by phone. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight. Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. On Capitol Hill this morning, the Kavanaugh hearings were just beginning. This is the confirmation process for Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh when California Senator Kamala Harris threw in a surprise.
Good morning. I welcome everyone to this confirmation hearing on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chairman.
To serve as Associate Justice.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized for a question before we proceed. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized to ask a question before we proceed. The committee received just last night, less than 15 hours ago, 42,000 pages of documents that we have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman.
I extend a very warm welcome to Judge Kavanaugh.
We have not been given an opportunity to have a meaningful hearing
Ashley,
on the nominee.
Their two daughters.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with my colleague, Senator Harris. Mr. Chairman,
Judge
we received 42,000 documents that we haven't
and
been
everyone
able
else joining
to review
us
last
today.
Night, and we believe this hearing should
I know
be postponed.
This is an exciting day for all of you here, and you're rightly proud
Mr. Chairman,
of
Chairman, if we cannot be recognized, I move to adjourn.
The American people.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn.
Directly from Judge Kavanaugh later this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn.
It seemed that you should hear that entire minute plus instead of just sound bites from it. So there you have it. That was California Senator Kamala Harris earlier today, starting and leading the Senate Democrats' opposition to the hearings. The hearings have begun, however, and that's where we're going to start our weekly conversation with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Hello, Ken. I think the tone of contention has now been set.
Oh, no, absolutely, Beth. And I'm really glad that you played that entire thing, because rarely have you ever heard that kind of bitterness and confrontation at a Supreme Court hearing. Look, the stakes are enormous. We're replacing basically, or at least the president is hoping to replace a swing justice, Anthony Kennedy, with a more committed conservative in Brett Kavanaugh. And part of this, I think, is that the Democrats are still frustrated the fact that Chuck Grassley, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who did not allow a vote, let alone even a hearing for Merrick Garland in 2016. He was President Obama's choice for the Supreme Court. So part of it is that frustration. But part of it, as we heard Senator Harris say, and we also heard it from Amy Klobuchar and Cory Booker and other Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, basically saying that, one, the committee, only received like maybe 42,000 pages of documents last night, and there's no way in the world we could possibly have read them and reviewed them in time for this morning's hearings, and the fact that President Trump and the Trump administration are also denying the committee some perhaps 100,000 pages of documents from Kavanaugh's service in the George W. Bush administration. The Democrats are very frustrated, not only from Garland, but the way that the Republicans, in their words, are rushing through this nomination. And as Richard Blumenthal, the senator from Connecticut, and other Democrats have said, why the rush? We need to delay. Why are we rushing this through?
So, Ken, about the pages and pages that were not released or released at what you'd call last minute, it often happens in hearings that a whole lot of research comes in at the last minute, and that's just part of the pipeline process at Capitol Hill. However, for this hearing—
Nobody believes that, though.
Okay. I was going to say.
No, I was going to say, no, I appreciate what you do because you're one of those journalists who believe in fairness, Beth. No, I'm serious. Look.
Well, I do have to ask.
I want to let you. Right, that information does come in the last minute, but this is service during the Bush administration, and the fact is, everybody has known what he said about executive power and things like that. Of course, one of the big issues is executive power because Democrats fear that Brett Kavanaugh may ultimately have to vote on whether President Trump's views or actions are legal, not to mention about issues about things like abortion rights and things like that. But basically, gun rights, abortion rights, and executive power are all on display in this back and forth here. And a lot of this information is already available. The question is, one, the Trump administration won't allow it to be heard. And two, as I said, the thousands that were dropped last night hardly gave Democrats a chance to look at that before this morning's hearing began.
What about Senator Harris in the role of leading the interruption? And the Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar jumped right in, as you said, and you heard her voice. But what about the positioning of the California senator in the role this morning?
Well, I mean, look, we could always ascribe any kind of motive we want. There's no question that Senators Harris, Klobuchar, and Booker are, at least if they haven't said it themselves, are thought to be looking at a presidential bid in 2020. So you notice that some of the more senior Democrats on the committee, like Blumenthal, like Pat Leahy, who's the former chair of the committee, they have basically let the junior members go forward. But that they express the frustration that you can't, get along or whatever. You know, you can't just sit back. And the fact is, they're just angry at the fact that, one, there was no vote, no hearings for Merrick Garland. And now you see Chuck Grassley pushing it through, saying we don't want to wait. Now, one thing we have to remember is that
Yeah, you're going to talk about the voting. That's important.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, given the fact that it's a 50-49 Senate right now, 50 Republicans, 49 Democrats. Now, of course, it will be 51 pretty soon because Doug Ducey, the governor of Arizona, will name a successor to the late John McCain. But let's just say if it's just one or two Republicans have to vote no, that would kill it. But I don't think one or two Republicans will vote no. All the Democrats have to stay united to vote no. And yet I don't know if all the Democrats could stay united either. There are at least two or three Democrats under tremendous pressure back home, including Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, all of whom voted for Neil Gorsuch last year, and they're under pressure to vote for Kavanaugh as well. So for all the delaying tactics that the Democrats are trying to make work, all the complaints they have about a lack of transparency that they're getting from the Republicans and the White House, the Democrats are still at a big disadvantage, especially given the fact that the filibuster is long gone and you can no longer stop this nomination by a failure of getting 60 votes. Right now, if the Republicans have 50 or 51, Brett Kavanaugh joins the court.
I wonder how this is going to proceed, because the order of things, as we were told in general, would be that each of the members of the panel will be making a statement. Then three different people will introduce Judge Kavanaugh. Then he will speak himself. But this might take 2 days. So when it's Kamala Harris's turn on the panel, or anybody else's, to speak who wants to oppose, do they go ahead and make their statement, Ken, do you think? Or do they use that moment to, again, return to some sort of strategy to try to delay the hearing?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know exactly where, but it's a combination of both. I mean, Kamala Harris, one, will talk about delaying the hearings and saying that there shouldn't be a rush to judgment, but she still has legitimate questions. There are legitimate questions that Brett Kavanaugh has to answer. And so the Cory Bookers, the Amy Klobuchars, the Kamala Harrises, the Pat Leahy's, the Richard Blumenthal's, they will all, Dianne Feinstein, who's been pretty quiet, and she's the vice chair, the co-chair, I should say, of the Judiciary Committee. We're going to hear from all of them. It's a combination of Chuck Grassley, why are you pushing a rush to judgment? But two, they have legitimate questions of Kavanaugh. So I expect today will be just the opening statements, which you'll hear mostly about why we're rushing this through. You're going to hear 2 days of questioning, Wednesday and Thursday, of questionings, and on Friday, I guess you'll hear testimony from outside witnesses about the good and the bad of Brett Kavanaugh, and then you'll have a vote pretty soon. And again, unless something startling happens, unless they managed to delay it. But if you listen to Orrin Hatch and Chuck Grassley and other Republicans on the committee, they are in no mood to delay anything. They feel that Trump has the right to have his own Supreme Court nominee, and he does, but I suspect that Barack Obama had that same right, and he was denied it in 2016. Regardless, you're going to see a lot of contentiousness. You're going to see a lot of anger. But when all is said and done, will anything change? And that's the real question.
Yeah, I wonder what this story will be next Monday when we talk on September 10th. And I'll let everybody know that you can listen and watch the hearings streaming live on our website, which a lot of people across the country and some outside the country are going to be watching as well, Ken.
Oh, I watched it this morning. I mean, there was a lot of emotion there. There was, I mean, between the protesters, the anguish of the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, you always think, every time I see Chuck Grassley, he always seems like he didn't expect this or he doesn't feel he deserves this. But then again, I always go back to Merrick Garland. So it's always like, who started this mess? Who fired the first shot? And we could probably go back to the Abe Fortas nomination in 1968. It just goes back a long way with this partisanship.
Well, public protests and then some uprising from the Senate Democrats couldn't have been a surprise. I do want to move on to how much of the past week was focused on services and tributes for John McCain. And you just mentioned that question about the successor, which we could expect to come any time, I guess, this week, because the governor had said once the funeral services and tributes had ended, then he'd get to the point about making an announcement.
That's absolutely true. And of course, so many names have been mentioned. A lot of people are talking about Sidney McCain. But Doug Ducey, who's the Republican, is trying to walk a very fine line between the McCain supporters in Arizona and the Trump supporters. I suspect there are more Trump supporters in Arizona than there are McCain supporters. And Ducey, who has a tough reelection battle, knows that he's in a tough battle. So I suspect that either way, he's going to have to pick a Republican who is acceptable by both sides. That's not easy to do in this era's Republican Party. But at the same time, whomever he picks, I would assume that is a certain vote for Brett Kavanaugh. And to be honest with you, for all of John McCain's independence and maverickosity, remember that word?
I love it.
just go back to previous issues, editions of Insight, and right, you'll hear the definition of it. But for all the maverick positions taken by John McCain, he still was always expected to vote for Trump Supreme Court nominees. I think if memory serves, during the campaign, he said that he would never vote for a Hillary Clinton Supreme Court nominee. I think that's a pretty accurate quote. So for all of, you know, all the left's lauding and celebrating and mourning the loss of John McCain, and it is a tremendous loss, there's no question that John McCain was still a Republican first when it came to things like judicial nominees.
Do you have a guess at the successor, Ken?
Well, there were some people. There's a state treasurer, her name is slipping my mind, whom Ducey appointed as state treasurer. She would be the first female senator from Arizona. And that's interesting because in the other seat where Jeff Flake is retiring, there are two women running for that seat, Kyrsten Sinema and Martha McSally. So it's very possible you'll wind up with, you know, starting off with no female senator in Arizona's history to two women serving in the Senate from that state, which would be pretty remarkable. Of course, Republicans have had that California has had that since 1992 when both Feinstein and Boxer were elected, but other states are finally catching up.
Are you talking about Eileen Klein?
That's who I'm thinking of. Thank you very much.
Okay. Just wanted to be sure.
You're very smart. You do your homework. Unlike some people who just talk out of the side of their mouth and have no idea what they're doing, you actually do research.
You know, I can't let you give me that much credit because that big clunk that you heard was me dropping my phone because I was looking it up on Google. So sorry.
I thought that big clunk you heard was Ken Rudin, but okay, whatever.
You are listening to Ken Rudin, the political junkie. But since you're talking about Arizona, I want to talk about another state, and that is Florida, because Florida held its primary, and the governor's race, a lot of people are saying, might have brought 2020 right to 2018. We have to talk about these results, Ken.
Well, you know something, that's an interesting way of looking at 2020 into 2018, because what we're seeing, I mean, if you want to just simplify things, and I'm not saying these are not my words, but you have basically a left-wing Democrat and a right-wing Republican. And I mean, basically the race for governor should be who should raise taxes, who should fix the infrastructure, things like that. But this has become so ideological. Andrew Gillum is the African-American mayor of Tallahassee, who was not supposed to win the primary. He was backed by George Soros and Tom Steyer and Bernie Sanders, and basically the left of the Democratic Party, and he won an upset victory, whereas the Republican side, Ron DeSantis is a congressman from Orlando, very conservative, very right-wing, who was a darling of Fox News, and President Trump endorsed him back in June. He wasn't supposed to win the primary until really Trump got involved, and as Trump has proven many times, he can be very effective in Republican primaries. We'll see what happens in November, but in the primaries, if you're a Trump favorite, that's usually good news, and DeSantis got it. But here's the rub. There are two things that are hurting both candidates right now. One, there is an FBI inquiry into the corruption into the Tallahassee city government. Andrew Gillum, who's the mayor, says he's not a subject or a target. We don't know that for sure. And then within a day of Andrew Gillum's nomination, Ron DeSantis said that I hope that voters won't monkey this up. And everybody took that as a dog whistle for racism. And plus the fact there's a whole bunch of robocalls going on in Florida with some kind of like a minstrel voice saying, Andrew Gillum, and you hear the sound of drums and monkeys in the background. If this sounds like 1950s and the Klan, but it's 2018. It's despicable. DeSantis has vilified it, and he said this has no place in politics, but the ugliness is out, and it's going to be a very brutal, expensive, and contentious race for governor.
Andrew Gillum won the Democratic primary with a little over 34% of the vote, and Ron DeSantis won the Republican primary with a little over 56%. The state overall has been purple. It does tend to be red in primaries. I just think it should be on kind of political watch for everybody all across the country, because what happens in Florida is always important, but what happens right now can tell us a lot about where we're going a couple years from now.
That's absolutely true. And of course, whenever you have a candidate, a election that involves race, you know, that's always something to watch. And regarding the percentage you just quoted, to be fair, the Republican primary was really between two people. Gillum had five opponents, including Gwen Graham, the daughter of former governor and Senator Bob Graham. So, I mean, it was a multi-candidate. The fact that he won with 30% and change was a tremendous victory. But both of them, you know, supposedly came out of their primaries and energized, but it's gotten ugly within one day, and it's going to be certainly ugly for the 60 or so days to go before November 6th.
Right, and Gwen Graham was only 3 percentage points behind. Okay, Ken, so there's so much to talk about. I do want to leave with just the name Aretha Franklin, because besides John McCain's funeral, Aretha's brought out dignitaries, a former president of the United States, and remarkable tributes. I think ceremonies and speeches at both events say a lot about where our country has been, where we are today, and who these iconic people were.
You know, obviously, Aretha was not obviously about politics, whereas the McCain thing was all about politics, but it was the loss of two people whom many in this country loved, and especially with Aretha. I mean, you didn't have to be a D or an R or a liberal or a conservative to know that she was just a one of a kind. And And I listened to a lot of that. I mean, I listened to the first 6 hours of Al Sharpton's tribute. Then I had to do something. I don't know what I did. But I mean, there were a lot of great tributes to her. And
hey, as Ken, so many people you said, you need to get a life. You really do.
That's exactly right. I have to find out who Eileen Klein is.
Yeah, well, I'll loan you my phone and you can drop it on your desk, too. Have a good week. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Beth.
That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and he'll join us next Monday. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. California lawmakers wrapped up their session Friday night, not without some drama, which always comes with this deadline. And now Governor Brown needs to make some decisions, to sign or to veto. That is the question. Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler is here to recap what did and didn't happen. And I don't say that to be light or trite about any of it, because what happens here at the finish line is critical, and especially for this governor. It was his final end of session.
He came onto the floors of both the Senate and the Assembly shortly before session wrapped up at midnight, a kind of final swan song for him. He did, of course, continue to make his joke that he'll still be around causing trouble, maybe as the senator from Colusa County.
Well, Colusa County is his roots. And since you say that, tomorrow we have Miriam Powell in the studio, who wrote The Browns of California and traces those roots back to Colusa County and further beyond. Anyway, how was the level of drama this time?
It was, I think, a little lower than past years for a couple of reasons. One is that the big bills, we kind of knew by Friday night that the biggest of the big ones, the wildfire liability legislation, was going to pass. And also, because of the 72-hour in-print rule approved by voters in 2016, a constitutional amendment that makes the legislature wait to vote on bills until they've been in print for 3 full days, you couldn't do any last-minute amendments at the 11th hour, literally, and rush bills through. Everything had to be in print. And so, in a sense, there was a lot less running around wondering what games were afoot. It was all about trying to figure out, okay, does this bill have the votes? Does that bill have the votes? And so some things didn't get through. In particular, we learned on Friday that the effort to regionalize California's grid was going to stall for the year, a setback to Governor Brown. It's something he has been pushing for. But at the same time, other bills were moving forward, even bills that looked like they'd be a handful of votes short, a couple of police bills. Those measures moved forward in the end, too.
Let's go back to what you just mentioned, wildfire liability, and start there. This package of bills, and it's important to emphasize that this bill addresses fires that started in 2017 or moving forward, but not before 2017.
Yes. So there are going to be different rules for fires in 2017 and fires from 2019 moving forward. Not included in the bill, anything about fires in 2018.
Really? And sits in the gap?
Well, so at first I thought this was an oversight because it was a very hastily crafted measure up against a deadline Tuesday because of the 3-day in-print rule. But after asking around a bit more, it turns out that it may well have been intentional. Let's go through the rules because this is important. The end effect of this is going to be to transfer some of the burden from utility shareholders on Wall Street to utility ratepayers, you and me, here in California. So for 2017, the California Public Utilities Commission would conduct a stress test to determine the maximum amount of damages a utility could sustain without harming ratepayers or going bankrupt. And that would serve as a cap on their fiscal liability. And then costs that are passed along to ratepayers could be financed under a process called securitization, where you spread the costs out over several years to reduce the sticker shock on ratepayers' monthly utility bills. As for fires in 2019 and forward, the Public Utilities Commission will decide if a utility acted reasonably and will consider factors that include extreme weather conditions. And so depending on how things work out, the commission could order that costs be passed along to ratepayers and securitized. This is a change from the current system where the utilities are responsible for fires that are caused by their electrical equipment, even if they weren't negligent. And in the past, utilities have sought to pass some of the costs along to ratepayers, and it tends to not happen that much. So in theory, it could happen more moving forward.
What was some of the final comment from legislative leaders about this package of bills?
Well, let's hear from Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon. I spoke with him in his office late Friday night.
Well, you're right that SDG&E did the right thing, and you're absolutely right. And I think everybody to a person in our legislature believes that PG&E has not done the right thing over and over and over again. They have consistently not learned their lesson. That being said, this is not a bailout. If you look at the stress tests involved, which was something that we as an assembly were insistent on, they're going to have to pay back. Depending on the CAL FIRE investigation, they're going to be held responsible to a large extent for what they did.
So what we heard the speaker say is San Diego Gas and Electric has earned the respect of lawmakers for its actions in response to 2007 wildfires in San Diego, making necessary investments to get their system to a better place than it was at that time. And the speaker does not feel, and apparently, according to him, lawmakers everywhere in the Capitol do not feel that PG&E has nearly done what it should on that. And so there is anger toward PG&E. And yet here you go with the bill that was being passed. You hear the speaker insisting it is not a bailout. Ratepayer groups are calling it a bailout, but it does not include what PG&E truly sought, which was a change to the overall liability law known as inverse condemnation that we've talked about on previous shows. So the utilities did not get what they most wanted, but they did get something which they argue is crucial to avoid getting into bankruptcy. If a utility goes bankrupt, then a federal bankruptcy judge decides how the money gets spent and what gets passed along to ratepayers, rather than keeping the decisions, you know, for the California Public Utilities
Commission. Seems then that we might have a separate future conversation about the big fires already of 2018. And I saw this morning that the Mendocino Complex fire is now 97% contained. As an aside, there was a fire that erupted overnight, a much smaller one near Emigrant Gap in the Sierra. It is a U.S. Forest Service fire. CAL FIRE is assisting, but you were on the news desk this morning. So do you have an update on that fire?
They actually downgraded the size of it. Last night, they were saying 650 acres. This morning, it's 500 acres. Last night, it was 0% contained. This morning, it is 10% contained. I believe a handful of campsites and residences have been evacuated and closed. And, of course, we'll continue to monitor it. Right now, I got the feeling from talking to the Placer County Sheriff's Department this morning that they weren't running around in panic, that they felt pretty good about where things were at. But if the weather changes, it's a very dense area full of brush, full of trees, area that hasn't burned in decades. So this is one we'll need to keep an eye on. And of course, Cap Radio News will.
You're listening to Ben Adler, Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Very quick check-in on net neutrality. And since that's going to the governor, where you think the governor might be, I know I'm never supposed to ask you about predictions, but
I'm not going to speculate on the gov on that. I sound like his press office. We're not going to speculate. But this is Jerry Brown. It is a measure that went further than the Obama era net neutrality restrictions. And so we'll see if the telecom industry is able to lobby the governor. It's a hard veto for a Democrat. It was a bill that once it got to 41 votes, everyone jumped on top of it because once it passed, you want to be seen as voting for it politically. We'll see. There's going to be a lot of people asking the governor to sign it and a lot of people asking him to veto it.
Can you go quickly through public safety bills?
Sure.
Okay.
So the big headliner, the governor signed the bail reform bill last week. So that one is over and done with.
Although there's already a referendum.
Thank you. So it is not over and done with, to your point, Beth, and thank you for reminding me. So if the bail industry is able to gather enough signatures to force it onto the November 2020 ballot, importantly, the law would not take effect until voters weigh in. If it doesn't qualify, it takes effect in October 2019, but more likely there will be money there and an industry where, 7,000 people are losing their jobs who are going to be more than happy to hit the streets to get signatures. So we'll see what happens there. Other bills to keep track of. The police use of force bill did not get through, but several other bills did, including police records, making it easier for the public and media to access police records, officer records for certain circumstances. Body camera bill got through, and a measure that deals with allowing judges to strike mandatory sentence enhancements for prior felony convictions got through as well. Some of these bills really frustrated Republicans that Democrats were able to put them through. Let's hear now from Assembly Republican Leader Brian Daly.
I mean, you look at the
sweeping change in this legislation cycle. It's bail, it's reducing sentencing, and we just came off of, 47 and 57, AB 109. We have a lot of, they're letting out 100 lifers, according to Assemblymember Cooper, a month. I'm certain not all those people got just thrown in jail accidentally or prison. So I think we're going to be facing some, definitely public safety issues in California.
There is much more background on these bills at capradio.org. Let's wrap up, Ben, with something about the clock. Yeah, because we have public school start times and we have bar and nightclub closing times.
No relation other than the word clock between under 18s in school and bars staying open potentially
until
4 a.m.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So what about the 4 a.m. bar bill?
It passed. We'll see if the governor signs it. An effort last year failed in the legislature. This year, it's been narrowed down to large cities. That includes Sacramento as being in this pilot program. So we'll see if the city decides to move forward with it.
Okay. And public schools potentially starting no earlier than 8:30 in the morning?
Secondary schools, so junior high and high schools. Public only, but public charter schools are included in that. Yes. And that's a bill going to the governor that really broke down not on party lines, but it was a question of what's easier, what's best for kids, and contrasted to how working families could handle a later school start time.
Okay, very good. Glad to have you in the studio. Thanks, Ben.
Anytime.
That is Ben Adler, Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. More at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In 1965, the U.S. government tried to replace migrant farm workers with high school students. It's a program that failed, but it has not been forgotten. NPR contributor Gustavo Arellano wrote a powerful story about this experiment. We've linked the story to our website so you can read the full piece. And Gustavo is joining us by phone right now to talk about it. Hi, Gustavo. I'm so glad to have you on Insight. Welcome.
Gracias for having me.
I don't think you were even alive when this happened in 65, were you?
No.
I didn't think so. So how did it land on your radar?
I write a column, a weekly column for the Los Angeles Times about California everything. So earlier this year, I wrote an essay arguing for the bill that's trying to get ethnic studies a requirement in all high schools. But I also said that as part of that, every student in California, before they graduate, they should spend 1 week on a farm, just because farming has historically been so important to California. So it got a lot of reaction, and it also got me an email from a gentleman named Randy Carter who said, I love your idea because I saw it happen before. And so he tells me this crazy story about that, 1965, him and thousands of other high schoolers from across the country, they went to work on the farm as part of this government program. And he had all the research. He's from Hollywood, so he had all this research, and he shared a lot of it with me. And immediately I'm like, oh my God, this is a story. I gotta pursue this further.
So this group of high schoolers was referred to as the A Team, and will you explain why?
So a bit of background. In 1954, the United States government ended the Bracero program, which was a treaty between the United States and Mexico that allowed Mexican men to come to the United States legally and work on farms, only temporarily. Then they were supposed to come back, but it got a lot, it was rife with exploitation, and so the American government ended in 64. 1965 happens, the Secretary of Labor under the Johnson administration says, we need workers because we just lost hundreds of thousands of men. So let's do high school athletes. Because also his thing was that there's also a lot of unemployment for high schoolers over the summer. So he thought, let's kill two birds with one stone. And of course, he knew that there was no way high schoolers would want to do it. So he tried to pitch it to athletes saying, hey, or to a high school athletics department saying, hey, you want to keep your boys strapping and occupied during the summer, so nothing's going to do that better than to put them out in the field picking beets and cantaloupes and all that.
You actually talked to at least one of the participants, and it didn't quite go as it was sold, did it?
Oh, no. I mean, think about it. Anyone any American that want to pick under broiling heat? No one does, let alone high schoolers. But it was Randy Carter, the original guy who contacted me. So he set up this great scene. So he was from San Diego. So him and about 25 of his classmates from a San Diego Catholic high school go out to Blythe, which, if you know Blythe, it is out in the middle of just hell. So the first day he describes, you know, you have to start picking early in the morning, and they were going to pick cantaloupe. You go before sunrise, and he's saying, oh, you think to yourself, it's not going to be that bad. You feel a wind behind you. It's not too hot at all. And then he says the very first ray of sunlight over the horizon, and we're thinking to ourselves, what did we sign ourselves up for? By 9 a.m., it was already 110 degrees. It would get so hot that the bologna sandwiches that they ate for lunch, they were kept under the shade, and they still got toasted.
Gustavo, I'm probably a little closer to this than you might expect, because in high school, where I lived in Wisconsin, it was offered to us as a summer job. My sister and I, we got on buses, Gustavo, my sister and I, and we detasseled corn in the fields. And I think we were paid about $1.25 an hour. We had to bring our sack lunch. We wore gloves, and it was miserable. And I have never had anything itch as badly as the polleny tassels on that corn.
Oh, yeah. You know, this is a reality about people do not want to think how we get our food. People think, oh, it just magically showed up in Whole Foods, like it grew in the warehouse or something like that. But no, there are men and women and even children who go through, I mean, picking tassels is one thing. Now imagine if you're out in the field picking beets or cutting garlic or artichokes or going up on fruit trees and just picking them. It is hard work after just one day. So what ended up happening with a lot of these kids from the A-team, after just 2 weeks, hundreds of them quit or went on strike or complained. So it was just a complete, utter disaster that the United States government not only never did it again, but it just got disappeared. Like, I had never heard of it. Most Chicano studies professors or immigration scholars that I talked to or approached never heard of it. And because I think it was just an embarrassment for everyone. It's like one of those things, like, it wasn't a human tragedy. It was just, it was just dumb.
Say a little bit more about one of the history professors you spoke to who had a lot of comment about this, and I'm talking about Professor Lori Flores.
Yeah, Lori Flores, I always liked her work. She's a really, at Stony Brook University in New York State, and so she was one of just two academics that I knew had even written a little bit about it. So I talked, and so she did a book about the history of field workers in California, especially Mexican field workers. And so she joked that before she started doing her research, that the only A-team she had ever heard of course, was the old television series with Mr. T and all that stuff. And so, I thought she made a very powerful point for my story, was that these students, they were able to put in words and with their whiteness the complaints that Mexican-Americans have been saying for decades about exploitation in the fields. No one pays attention to a Mexican who complains. They just assume, oh, yeah, it's your work, so do it. But when you have high schoolers, when you have Johnny living in, Carmichael or something, and he's now forced to pick in the field, and he's complaining that there's no bathrooms and they have horrible food and they're getting paid nothing, oh, yeah, people are going to complain, and the farmers and the government's going to listen. But when it's just Mexicans, like, who cares about Mexicans?
You're listening to Gustavo Arellano. He's talking about his recent piece for NPR titled "When the U.S. Government Tried to Replace Migrant Farm Workers with High Schoolers." We'll link that piece to our website. Gustavo is a longtime guest on NPR's Barbershop segments. He's the former editor of the Orange County Weekly. And I'm going to note the satirical column that is really popular that has become a book, Ask a Mexican. And boy, if you want to get into some real raw conversation about what misconceptions or curiosities do we have, it sure showed up in the column, didn't it?
Oh, it was a great column. I don't write it anymore, unfortunately, but the book's still out there. People should get it.
Why was it important for you to write about this experiment back in 1965? Why is it relevant? And what's the reaction been, Gustavo?
I wrote about it because it was a great story. As a reporter, I'm always looking for great stories. I love hidden histories. That's always been a passion of mine. So being able to tell it, and I thought there was modern-day ramifications when when there's farmers saying that we need more immigration, not less immigration, because our crops are rotting in the field. And also when you have a president who says that the Mexicans who come up, they not only steal jobs from Americans, but they're rapists and all, you know, all the other blabbering that he has done, not just the president, but other people. It's important to show that you need some compassion. And the best way to see compassion with these migrants is to do the work that, you know, to do the work that you're not doing, frankly, to do the work that keeps you hungry, or no, that feeds you and that builds your houses. And the, you know, I thought I was going to get some bad feedback, like people saying, oh, you know, just propaganda. But no, the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. The story went viral. And, you know, when was the last time, maybe I shouldn't say that, but when was the last time an NPR story truly went viral? And it did with this one. And I think that people not only did not know the history, but they could see, like, wow, like, this is something that was crazy, and yet the government did it. And now, you know, and maybe we shouldn't bring this back, but at least it taught us, like, that, yeah, at least some Americans, and now, you know, all the boys who participated in it, they're in their, like, late 60s, early 70s at this point, but maybe we should talk to them about how, quote-unquote, easy it is to do the work that Americans won't.
One last question, then. You talked to Randy Carter, and he'd been trying to get this story made into a movie forever and ever, and he's worked on some really big movies. He knows some important people. Do you think now maybe we will see a movie on this topic?
I would hope so. And he said, I didn't put this in the piece, but he said that the reason it got optioned twice, but the reason it never got made into a movie was because people who would buy it, they just couldn't believe it. They could not believe that this actually happened. And they thought it would just be way too surreal to be able to make something out of it. Like he said, it was just misery attached all around to it. And if you talk to Randy, he was just such a delight to interview. And yeah, no, he worked on Apocalypse Now. He worked on The Conversation. He worked a long time on Seinfeld. So this is a guy who had some sway. I think now, I think it would make a great movie. Yeah, like I do think it has to be somewhat comedic just because it's so surreal. But I always say, especially when I used to do my Ask the Mexican column, sometimes satire is the best way to approach something. And if you want to show the absurdity of American immigration and the cluelessness that Americans have about some of the hardest jobs around, you know, what better way to show that than telling the truth about the summer a bunch of high schoolers tried to pick crops?
Well, I agree with you. I think there's going to be a movie, and let's talk again when that happens. Okay, Gustavo?
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much for your time today.
Gracias.
That is Gustavo Arellano. Again, we'll link that piece to our website, capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. This news has just been announced that from Arizona, U.S. Senator John Kyle has been named as John McCain's successor. And there will be more about that continuing throughout the day. You can find the news at capradio.org. That does cap the conversation and the speculation that you heard even this morning in my conversation with Ken Rudin. So again, former U.S. Senator John Kyle named as the successor to John McCain in Arizona. Now back to California politics, and on the November ballot, there will be a statewide rent control measure. It's Proposition 10. It will be the focus of quite a bit of debate and certainly money in campaign ads between now and Election Day. In the studio with me is Chris Nichols. He's been exploring and researching Prop 10. And by the way, this is the start of an ongoing series we'll air in which we cover the California propositions in this election cycle. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Beth. Good to be here.
So this rent control measure comes out of an intense focus in California and across the country on the housing crisis.
That's right. It comes as we have quite an affordable housing crisis on our hands, and it's one solution that supporters say could make a difference. But of course, you have quite a few opponents who say just the opposite. They say that this could make matters worse.
This would repeal the state's Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act. And if you would explain Costa-Hawkins, we get more context.
Sure. That's the existing state law that governs rent control in California. And right now, in California, cities cannot place rent control on apartments built after 1995. They also cannot place rent control on condominiums or single-family homes. And so by repealing this state law, cities would be able to craft their own potentially much stronger rent control rules.
So there's strong support and strong opposition to this. Will you lay out the arguments on each side?
Well, the supporters say, you know, they talk about what we see every day, the skyrocketing rents, the double-digit increases that we've seen in places like Sacramento, a city with one of the fastest rising rents in the United States. And so I think it comes out of just a real frustration and concern that people are starting to be displaced from their communities as rents continue to go up. Opponents, including apartment associations, developers, builders, say that if you expand rent control and allow it to restrict what someone can charge, then construction will slow down and you'll have even less housing and the affordable housing crisis will get worse.
You spoke to the director of the Sacramento chapter of the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. This is one of the groups advocating for Prop 10.
That's right. That's Giovanna Fajardo, and she is a supporter of Prop 10.
The housing costs are going up because of the corporate landlords and the big real estate in particular. They're the ones that are making the prices go up. They're the ones that are deciding to raise up the tenants' rents 2-3 times a year.
So her argument tends to be in the bigger overall crisis and a belief that this will make a difference. The opponents are saying it's just going to antagonize the crisis. Will you say more about their position?
That's right. They say that, you know, a builder potentially looking to invest in a city like ours will shy away and will go somewhere else where rent control is not in place. They also talk about smaller landlords who maybe would take their rental unit off the market and do something else with it that's more profitable. So they say that there's a real concern about the supply of housing.
And here's Steve Maviglio, who is a spokesman for the No on Prop 10 campaign.
It will result in a housing freeze. You can expect people to stop trying to build affordable housing because it doesn't pencil out for them. It will force a lot of homeowners, single-family owners who rent out their homes to stop doing that.
So about the millions that will be poured into this campaign, that's already begun.
That has. I mean, this is, we're talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars. I believe at last check it was more than $40 million that's been raised for and against this ballot measure, with the opponents raising, I don't have the exact number, but it was over $30 million. And that is coming from a lot of large real estate apartment groups, people who, again, feel that they would be potentially losing out on business, quite a bit of business if this was to go into effect. Supporters, I think they have raised around 12 or so million dollars. Their largest, the largest financial supporter is the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. That's a nonprofit based in Los Angeles. It's been very active in supporting political campaigns. The California Nurses Association has also donated $50,000 in support of Proposition 10, as has the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 3299. Their PAC donated $60,000 in favor of this.
Sacramento, Chris, is among the local governments that are trying to come up with their own effort and, in fact, dealing with rent controls specifically in their own jurisdiction. It's an issue that will come up at the city council meeting tonight. Cap Radio's Bob Moffitt will be there, and you can follow his coverage. But what happens in this the competing interests, which has happened on many other issues, but as it pertains to rent control?
Well, I think that one of the most interesting parts of this is if this does pass, cities like Sacramento, as you mentioned, will have the option to tailor rent control as they see best fit for their city. And I think the opponents don't want to take that chance. I think they are worried that cities will go too far. But I think it is interesting that the measure would not change anything overnight. It would say to cities, okay, now you have a chance to go back to the drawing board and craft rent control the way you think would best work in your city.
Is there any polling yet on where voters are? I actually haven't seen any myself.
I have not seen polling on this one. I know the other measure that's drawing quite a bit of attention, the repeal of the gas tax measure, there is support for that overall. That is a good question. I don't know the answer to that one.
All right. To be continued then. Thank you so much. And again, I'm glad that we have begun the series on propositions, always illuminating to know exactly what the question is on the ballot.
That's right. And we'll have more coverage and more fact checks, I imagine, on this and other key measures on the ballot.
All right. That is Chris Nichols. And you can find more at capradio.org. Again, continuing coverage that you can watch and hear on the Kavanaugh hearings on our website. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruiak. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Because, baby, I won't even bother to let you need my soul for flatter. Because I'll just come back stronger.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.